Blog Talk Radio.
Universal and international in orientation.
A belief in the need to be prepared for an attack either by participating in one, survivalism.
Yeah. Opposing genetically engineered food.
Opposing surveillance. Most Americans assume that only bad people have to worry about draconian anti-terror laws. But as the above list shows, this isn't true. When even Supreme Court justices and congressmen worry that we are drifting into a dictatorship, we should all be concerned.
That must be an article. 2 U.S. Supreme Court justices and numerous other top government officials warn of dictatorship. And Justice Souter and O'Connor, intelligence agency heads and congressmen, all warn of tyranny in America. Former Supreme Court Justice David Souter told the University of New Hampshire School of Law that the pervasive civic ignorance in the U.S. could bring dictatorship. He said, "I don't worry about our losing a Republican government in the United States because I'm afraid of a foreign invasion. I don't worry about it because of a coup by the military, as has happened in some other places. What I worry about is that when people are not addressed, people will not know who is responsible."
What I worry about is that when problems are not addressed, people will not know who is responsible.
And when the problems get bad enough, as they might do, for example, with another serious terrorist attack, as they might do with another financial meltdown, some one person will come forward and say, "Give me total power and I will solve this problem." And that is how the Roman Republic fell. Augustus became emperor not because he arrested the Roman Senate. He became emperor because he promised that he would solve problems that were not being solved.
What's this right here? Let's see if we can get this. It's from YouTube.
That's just a suit.
Let's see what he's saying.
Hi, I'm Debbie Scurry, and I'm from Wyndham. And my question tonight is really around where we started this conversation, which is really around schools.
Around the what?
Schools.
Oh.
I've heard a lot this evening about democratic principles, civic engagement, and I guess I'm wondering, Justice Souter, if you could share with us your thoughts about what the appropriate role and probably responsibility as well of our schools to produce civically engaged students.
Well, I'll have to be careful of that one because I could talk even longer on that than on some of the other things that I've talked on. But I'll start with the bottom line. I don't believe there is any problem of American politics and American public life which is more significant today than the pervasive civic ignorance of the Constitution of the United States and the structure of government. I hope every one of you runs for the legislature. I won't spend a lot of time on statistics, but we know with pretty reliable evidence that 2/3 of the people in the United States do not know that we have 3 separate branches of government. I don't have the name of it, but I can remember hearing about a survey back 4 or 5 years ago in which a substantial percentage of Americans believed that the Supreme Court of the United States was a committee of the Congress. It didn't used to be this bad. When I was in school, we had actually, in the course of high school, there were 2 required civics courses. When we got out of high school, we may not have known a lot, but we at least had a basic understanding of the structure of American government, the structure of state government, for that matter. And what that gave us was not only a kind of a framework to hang the other thing, hang on the things that we learned later. It gave us a basic sense of where responsibility lies for given problems within the government. And a corollary of that was we certainly understood where responsibility lay in matters that were the business of the legislative branch or the Congress of the United States. And we knew that we could influence that by voting. Today, that I don't believe there would have been any two-thirds ignorance rule back at that time. Starting about 1970, the teaching of civics went into decline, from which it has never significantly recovered. The good news, I know simply from what I've learned in New Hampshire, is there are a lot of terrific civics teachers in New Hampshire who are trying to turn that around. One of their problems is that they don't necessarily have the material support to do it very well, and the demands on teaching, and this includes the demands that are imposed by the No Child Left Behind rule, makes it very difficult to find the time for more civics. But the reason I said that I think it is the most significant problem that we've got is that I think some of the aspects of current American government that people on both sides find frustrating are in part a function of the inability of people to understand how government can and should function. It is a product of civic ignorance. What I worry about is a remark that Benjamin Franklin made, and Susan Leahy quoted Jefferson at the beginning about how an ignorant people can never remain a free people. Democracy cannot survive too much ignorance. Franklin, in effect, had a comment to which the Jefferson comment is a kind of an answer or a response. And you probably have heard this, but it bears repeating. Franklin was asked by someone, I think, on the streets of Philadelphia shortly after the 1787 convention adjourned, what kind of government the Constitution would give us if it was adopted. And Franklin's famous answer was, a republic, if you can keep it. You can't keep it in ignorance. I don't worry about our losing republican government in the United States because I'm afraid of a foreign invasion. I don't worry about it because I think there is going to be a coup by the military, as has happened in some other places. What I worry about is that when problems are not addressed, people will not know who is responsible. And when the problems get bad enough, as they might do, for example, with another serious terrorist attack, as they might do with another financial meltdown, some one person will come forward and say, give me total power and I will solve this problem. That is how the Roman Republic fell. Augustus became emperor not because he arrested the Roman Senate. He became emperor because he promised that he would solve problems that were not being solved. If we know who is responsible, I have enough faith in the American people to demand performance from those responsible. If we don't know, we will stay away from the polls. We will not demand it. And the day will come when somebody will come forward and we and the government will in effect say, take the ball and run with it. Do what you have to do. That is the way democracy dies. And if something is not done to improve the level of civic knowledge, that is what you should worry about at night. So, to end where I began, the support of civic education in the United States, including in this state, is a public problem and a public responsibility which is second to none.
Supreme Court Justice Souter. And I have to agree with him.
When I lived in Massachusetts, when we were in the ninth grade, I went to a public high school. We had to take a year-long course on civics and on government.
Yeah.
And it was excellent. But they don't have that in Connecticut.
They don't have it anywhere.
It was an excellent, excellent course.
And it's all due, like you said, to that.
Why, did you have to take civics when you grew up in Maine?
I had to take, there was a civics class there, I think. I can't remember what year it was in, but it was. I think it was in sophomore or junior year or something. And, my father was a civic-minded guy, you know. He ran for the student school board, and he did all kinds of things and kind of told us to toe the line and what your responsibilities were. You know, he was a government worker. He was a director of a port, immigration. And so, he was a bright guy, and he knew what had to be done, and he instilled that in us that we should vote, and we should
understand how the government works.
Yeah,
I think that's fair.
That
bills originate in the Congress and all those kinds of things.
And I remember him taking time and sitting down with us and going, this is a hell of a lot more important to your life than trying to figure out an equation over here. You know what I mean? He says, you're going to need this. And, we did. You're going to need to know,
Sadly, I don't think parents even understand today.
No, they don't. They really don't. And a lot of them don't. And it's a sad state of affairs. And that's what he was commenting on.
So let's go to the next article that we have here.
Okay, I just wanted to check something. I'd like to talk a little bit about on the verge of decriminalizing the possession of up to 10 grams of marijuana after the lower house of parliament Thursday agreed to align itself with the Senate's version of the legislation, according to Swiss New Portal. Final reading of the bill is expected to happen before the end of the fall session next week. That would bring Switzerland in line with most of the Western European neighbors, which tolerate small-time marijuana possession. And the moves come 4 years after voters rejected outright legalization in a modern and popular referendum.
Huh.
So, Swiss didn't want this or something. The other thing is, this one here, U.S. distrust in media hits new highs.
Okay. And this is Gallup Politics, and it's by Lamari Morales. U.S. distrust in media hits new high. Fewer Americans closely following political news now than in previous years. Americans' distrust in the media hit a new high this year, with 60% saying they have little or no trust in the mass media to report the news fully, accurately, and fairly. Distrust is up from the past few years, when Americans were already more negative about the media than they had been in years prior to 2004. The record distress in the media, based on a survey conducted on September 6th through 9th in 2012, also means that negativity toward the media is at an all-time high for a presidential election year. This reflects the continuation of a pattern in which negativity increases every election year compared with the year prior. The current gap between negative and positive views, 20 percentage points, is by far the highest Gallup has recorded since it began regularly asking the question in the 1990s. Trust in the media was much higher and more positive than negative in the years prior to 2004, as high as 72% when Gallup asked this question three times in the 70s. This year's decline in media trust is driven by independents and Republicans. 31% and 26% respectively expressed a great deal or a fair amount of trust, a record low, and down significantly from last year. Republicans' level of trust this year is similar to what they expressed in the fall of 2008, implying that they are especially critical of election coverage. Independents are sharply more negative compared with 2008, suggesting the group that is most closely divided between Barack Obama and Mitt Romney is quite dissatisfied with its ability to get a fair and accurate news coverage of this election. More broadly, Republicans continue to express the least trust in the media, while Democrats express the most. Independents' trust fell below the majority level in 2004 and has continued to steadily decline. Americans tend to pay more attention to political news in presidential years, and that is the case in 2012. However, Americans are less likely this year to be paying close attention to news about national politics than they were in 2008. The 39% who say they are paying close attention is up from last year, when Americans were paying a high level of attention compared with other non-election years, but down from 43% in September 2008. Despite their record low trust in media, Republicans are the partisan group most likely to be paying attention to news about national politics, with the 48% who are doing so similar to the 50% in 2008 and up significantly from 38% in 2004. Independents and Democrats are less likely than Republicans to be paying close attention, with their levels of attention similar to 2008 and 2004. What are the implications of this? Let's see. Americans are clearly down in the news media this election year, with the record high 6 and 10 expressing little or no trust in the mass media's ability to report the news fully, accurately, and fairly. This likely reflects the continuation of a trend seen in the recent years, combined with increased negativity toward the media that election years tend to bring. This is particularly consequential at a time when Americans need to rely on the media to learn about platforms and perspectives of the two candidates vying to lead the country. The lower the level of interest in news about national politics during this election year may also reflect the level of interest in presidential elections specifically. This survey was conducted immediately after the conclusion of both political conventions, and thus may indicate the level of attention paid to those events in particular. Since the survey was conducted, Democrats' enthusiasm about voting has swelled nationally and in swing states. On a broad level, Americans' high level of distrust in the media possesses a challenge to democracy and to creating a fully engaged citizenry. Media sources must clearly do more to earn the trust of Americans, the majority of whom see the media as biased one way or the other. All the same, there is an opportunity for others outside the mass media to serve as information sources that Americans do trust. Okay.
It's kind of interesting. I totally lost all faith in the media. I view it more as entertainment. You know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
Like,
I think a lot of Americans probably do.
Yeah, it's more entertainment.
So they seek out alternative media to find out what's going on.
A little on the science news, I was kind of interested to know. I'll just be brief on this. But this scientist says we could put the whole world's knowledge in 4 grams of DNA. While not the first project to demonstrate the potential of DNA storage, Church's team married next-generation sequencing technology with a novel strategy that encoded 1,000 times the largest amount of data previously stored in DNA. And I think that's phenomenal. 4 grams. I mean, you know a little about it? Yeah, all the knowledge in the world. Didn't we read this one last week?
Which one?
The one on Paul Ryan.
No. You talked about it.
I talked about it.
But
actually,
you talked about it to me, and you posted it, but you didn't.
I didn't read it.
Didn't read it. No.
This is one of the most frightening articles, really, that I can remember reading about any candidate. And this guy just happens to be our vice president.
No,
our vice presidential candidate.
On the Republican side. He just hit something on the side. Oh, here it is. Take a look at what Paul Ryan did to his own congressional district and be very scared for your... What?
For having to be very scared for your... That's what I learned. Okay. Before Paul Ryan was anointed as the Republican vice president candidate, Ryan reigned as the GOP resident economic genius and leading intellectual. However, his praise for major media outlets has long been divorced from the reality 1,000 miles away back in Ryan's first congressional district in southeastern Wisconsin. Even while Beltway media and even President Obama heaped kudos on Ryan for his bold economic proposals and intellectual audacity, the productive base and social health of his constituents have been severely deteriorating under the impact of the very policies he has aggressively championed.
Mm-hmm.
And Ryan, I'm just going to read one more and then I'll let you read the rest. Ryan triumphed trumpeted that the $1.2 trillion in Bush tax cuts showered largely on the richest 1%, pushed for the deregulation of Wall Street financial manipulations, and opposed 2007 efforts to rein in the financial industry's increasing risky practices, but then voted for a virtually unconditional bailout of the big banks after the meltdown of 2008 in order to save the free enterprise system. Ryan also voted for the auto bailout without any provisions to prioritize U.S. jobs, including those in his district. Further, Ryan has been a consistent supporter of the free trade deals with low-wage, repressive regimes that have fueled the offshoring of jobs. In recent years, Ryan's home district has lost thousands of families sustaining jobs. Its economic foundations have been dangerously hollowed out. Belco in Oak Creek shut down at a cost of 3,800 jobs, mostly going to Mexico. Chrysler in Kenosha, and 850 jobs sent to Mexico with the help of auto industry bailout funds. And General Motors in his hometown of Janesville eliminated 2,800 jobs directly with its pre-Christmas 2008 plant closing, while GM kept open a low-wage plant with parallel capacities in Silao, Mexico. The GM shutdown in Janesville wiped out another 3,800 jobs in nearby supplier plants. All right. The three major industrial counties in Ryan's district have endured devastating manufacturing jobs since 2000. With Kenosha County losing 30%, Racine County 33%, and Rock County an astonishing 54%. And predictable results of job losses. That's the one reason. More, this is this article on Ryan.
The results of Ryan's policies and the resulting economic wreckage have been grimly predictable. The persistently high unemployment has been accompanied by rising signs of social disintegration and distress throughout most of the district. Foreclosures in Rock County, home to Jansville and Beloit, have quadrupled since 2000. They have nearly tripled throughout the entire state. In Jansville, the GM shutdown created such a surplus of workers begging for jobs that the average wage fell from $23.27 in 2007 to $18.82 in 2010. Within 3 months of the GM closing, just before Christmas in 2008, the number of battered women seeking shelter at the YMCA Janesville's Family Violence Center nearly tripled. Janesville has been afflicted by major increases in child abuse and neglect. Janesville's rate of child poverty has nearly doubled to 47.1% since 2000. The percentage of children eligible for free or reduced-cost lunches ranges from 43% to 69% in the major cities of its district. Janesville has also experienced a near doubling in suicides over the first 2 years since the GM closing. Now, this is in Paul Ryan's district.
This is Paul Ryan's hometown.
Oblivious to suffering, yet Ryan has remained oblivious to this massive suffering, seemingly driven by his embrace of Ayn Rand's ideology of anti-social capitalism, which he recently and unconvincingly renounced in the face of complaints about her atheism. He has advocated and voted for cuts to the government protections and the social safety net desperately needed by families in his district, trying to hang on to their cars, their homes, and their dignity. Ryan is always willing to bestow bailouts on major banks and corporations, but worries that workers and the poor will lose their motivation to work if the government directs meaningful help to workers, the jobless, and the poor. Ryan claims that the U.S. safety net, pitifully thin compared to other advanced nations, is already in danger of seriously undermining the will to work. We don't want to turn this safety net into a hammock that ends up lulling people in their lives into dependency and complacency. After Ryan advanced pro-corporate policies that laid waste to his district, he followed up by seeking block programs that would relieve the human misery among us, among his constituents. Ryan has voted against extended unemployment benefits despite a persistent lack of job openings. Ryan has consistently imposed increases in the minimum wage in spite of growing evidence that the majority of women minimum wage workers are employed by giant firms. Ryan has opposed the S-CHIP healthcare program to aid low-income people, as well as vowing to repeal the Affordable Care Act in the face of rising needs for healthcare among the ranks of the uninsured. In Janesville, for example, over the last 2 years, we've seen a 77% increase in the number of patients. Ryan has voted against expansion of foreclosure prevention assistance in the face of evidence that prior efforts were far too weak and misdirected toward helping mortgage holders rather than families. Ryan has opposed expanded funding for job training in both his votes and his budget proposals. The cuts he is proposing would have a devastating effect on the hard-hit workers in Wisconsin, with cities like Racine and Beloit way above the national average in its unemployment. Clearly, Ryan would prefer that government resources be directed elsewhere to intruding into the sex lives of women and radically restricting their reproductive rights. Despite being identified for years with Ayn Rand's libertarianism and a philosophy of small government, Ryan has zealously pursued a legislative agenda to essentially criminalize abortion under virtually all circumstances, often in tandem with the now-toxic Representative Todd Akin from Missouri, who is now running for the Senate. Over the 13 years he's been in Congress, Ryan has voted 59 times, every time possible, to deny women access to abortion and even forms of contraception, notes Marilyn Capps, in these times. The 59 pieces of legislature range from declaring a fetus a human being with the full legal rights to allowing hospitals to refuse treatment to a woman who needs post-abortion care, even if she's at death's door. While Ryan's legislative team with Representative Akin has instantly gained a scorching media spotlight, escaping mainstream media attention, has been Ryan's little-discussed budget proposal to halt the authority of the U.S. government to tax foreign profits of U.S. corporations once they are brought back into the country. How the wealthiest Americans enrich themselves at government expense and stick you with the bill. This provision in Ryan's budget plan would be disastrous to both the U.S. jobs and tax revenue. Ryan's plans would ensure that any profits created offshore by U.S. corporations would never be taxed by the U.S. government, explains Johnson, who won the 2001 Pulitzer Prize for his work at the New York Times Tax Reporter. This would create a tremendous incentive to move more and more U.S. jobs overseas to escape taxes on profits that foreign workers produce for them. Corporations would thus gain a huge financial advantage in the offshoring those family-supporting jobs remaining in Ryan's home district and the rest of the U.S. In sum, Ryan's economic policies have intensified the incessant carpet bombing of the First District manufacturing base. But even more mercilessly, Ryan has led the strafing of the first aid stations, the safety net measures and programs designed to help underemployed and the jobless earn higher wages, feed their families, retain their homes, and get retrained for scarce new jobs. Child abuse and suicide is skyrocketing. The number of battered women have tripled. Foreclosures have tripled, and wages plummeting and more.
Absolutely frightening, huh?
Yeah, very, very scary.
Very scary. And it says that there's been a dictatorial coup in the Koch brothers out of a bunch of czars running the cities across Michigan. The most frightening thing is that the Koch brothers are 100% and have been constantly behind Paul Ryan. All right? And,
he's their creature.
Yeah, he's their creature. And remember Hines?
Yep.
Or Kane, rather. What's his name? Kane.
The black guy?
Yeah, the black guy.
He
was a Cokehead as well. And
created by the Koch brothers.
Totally, yeah. Totally Koch creation. But this guy scares the living bejesus out of me, of course, and for good reason. Now you understand. The guy is heartless. He's a deadbeat. The guy can't even handle his own constituents. Destroys his own constituency.
Anything to get ahead.
He keeps getting elected in that place either.
Probably rigged ballots.
Gotta be rigged ballots. Oh, here's another great guy. Metcalf says, lazy people don't deserve to vote.
Okay.
State Rep. Daryl Metcalf is nothing if not blunt.
Where is he from?
Citizenry to get the documents needed to vote. When asked about the 10 tens of thousands, if not more, Pennsylvanians who may not be able to vote on November 6th. Metcalf cited Romney's mention of the 47% of the country who would never take personal responsibility and care for their lives as evidence that some citizens do not deserve to vote. Host said, are you absolutely convinced that the methods to implement this law are effective and will in fact make sure no legitimate voter will be disenfranchised? And Metcalf said, I don't believe any legitimate voter that actually wants to exercise that right and takes on the according responsibility that goes with that right to secure their photo ID will be disenfranchised. As Mitt Romney said, 47% of the people that are living off the public dole, living off their neighbors' hard work, and we have a lot of people out there that are too lazy to get up and get out there and get the ID that they need. If individuals are too lazy, the state can't fix that. Well, what do you think, Lila? What do you
think? I was just listening. Go
right
ahead.
Yeah, what I said. The guy is saying the people are too lazy to get their voter ID.
I'm not sure I agree with that.
The problem I have with this article is they're not stating what the procedure is to get those voter
ID. In some states, it may have been made very, very difficult.
Yeah, and you know, I'm not really sure. It doesn't say in this article, unfortunately, how to go about it.
I think they've made it difficult in places like Florida and
Texas. I mean, all around the country.
Where there are large blocks of minorities and poor people.
That's right.
Made it very, very difficult because...
Well, one thing, it costs money to do it. Okay,
yeah.
You got to go in, you got to get it. Like here in the United States, you get it. Here in Connecticut, you got to get your license. Okay, you fix
and
your
it's quite
license.
Expensive.
Well, I don't know what it is.
Well, you get it for like 5 years and...
No, I got it. Maybe the most... I think it was... I forget how much it was. $55?
It must be more than that now. I don't know. It's quite expensive.
Yeah, it seems to go up every year. But they renew you for 5 years. But
Why don't don't we take a little music break again?
Yeah, and
we'll bring up those articles.
What's going on here around the country. So, let's go to a quick music break and we'll be back. Images and video below are disturbing, but must be shared. Now it is time to spread this information, right? And I don't know. It's more. I'll play some of it, but it's more. It's really something to be seen. There's some good news here on hemp. Hemp can repair DNA, right? I didn't mention that.
Go ahead.
Did you know that DNA can be damaged and repaired?
I read this article. I thought it was an article.
Well, DNA is the hereditary material found in humans, animals, and organisms. DNA is in every cell in our bodies, and each cell nucleus has DNA. It turns out that hemp oil can repair the DNA.
Yeah, so they claim in this article. I found that fascinating.
Yeah, you want to read it?
Mm-hmm.
For sure.
During the process of transcription, the information stored in genes' DNA is transferred. Oh, you read that?
No.
Is transferred to similar molecule called RNA, ribonucleic acid, in the cell's nucleus. Both the RNA and the DNA. Oh, I started in the wrong place.
Oh, that's okay.
It was too far down.
Okay.
The types of RNA. I'm on the right place. The type of RNA that contains the information for making a protein is called RNA, mRNA, because it carries the information or message from the DNA out of the nucleus to the cytoplasm. The genes direct protein production. For example, a protein, a long chain of amino acids, can be an enzyme that triggers a certain chemical reaction of the body. One function of a protein is to boost the immune system. There are many causes and many factors that cause damage to DNA. Oxidation, UV radiation from the sun, radiation from X-rays, viruses, plant toxins, and man-made chemicals like chlorine and hydrogen peroxide, hydrocarbons, smoke, pollution, to name a few. Some results of damaged DNA are premature aging, cancer, diabetes, Parkinson's, Alzheimer's, chronic fatigue syndrome, and many other conditions. Cells cannot properly function if the DNA is damaged. However, the cells can, through the chemical process, reverse the damage themselves. Hemp seed and hemp seed oil have been found to be a factor in DNA repair. Hemp has the perfect 3-to-1 ratio of omega fatty acids needed by the human body. One job of omega-3 is cellular repair. Hemp is 65% protein, 35% of which is globulin edistin protein. It is the protein that is closest to human globulin and is very easily digestible by the body. The protein is a major factor in DNA repair. As the cells use this protein to correct the damage, Because hemp is the highest sort of epistein protein and is responsible for boosting the immune system, it is a perfect addition to the diet. And here's the author. Thackara Wolford is a writer. Writer, entrepreneur, artist, and Reiki practitioner and hemp activist. She has experienced firsthand nutritional and healing benefits of hemp, and her passion is learning, writing, and educating others about the benefits of hemp. Benefits that encompass nutritional health for humans, a healthy environment, and a healthier economy. Because Becca also distributes Versativa, an amazing raw, clean, hemp-based nutritional supplement, and Restoration 90, a raw, clean, nutritional product with marine phytoplankton, hemp, and essential nutrients for optimum health. Interesting.
Yeah, we support her at our excellent blog, hempfeeler.com. So,
that's fascinating that hemp is such a great product.
Yeah.
And so many things that can be made out of it, too. Like a miracle plant, I think. We have about 4 minutes left.
That's okay. Anybody ever remember the fact that the Israelis don't have nuclear weapons?
Huh.
Did you ever hear that?
Well, we know they do. They have many.
Well,
we sold them to them. We should bring them.
Well, as it turns out, Israeli subs with nuclear weapons are located in the Gulf of Persian Gulf. Israel is planning to permanently station a submarine carrying nuclear cruise missiles in the Persian Gulf, as said the Sunday Times reported on Sunday. Israeli submarines have visited the Gulf before, but the decision has now been taken to ensure a permanent presence of at least one of the vessels, and the papers claim that the government has decided to station at least one of three submarines armed with nuclear missiles permanently within striking distance of Iran in the Persian Gulf. Aren't they wonderful?
Huh?
Oh, here's one. In Florida, did you read this about the one in Florida, where they can detain you indefinitely if you give them a large bill as a toll gate?
No, I didn't see that.
Yeah. U.S. Court of Appeals upholds the right of a toll road operators to detain drivers for using large denomination currency. Motorists can be held indefinitely at toll booths if they pay with large denomination bills, according to a federal appeals court ruling handing down Wednesday. A family of drivers, Joel Dever and Robert Chandler, filed suit last year arguing that they were effectively being held hostage by Florida Department of Transportation and a government contractor in charge of the state tolls, toll road, Fenuel, Inc. Okay.
Fenuel.
Fenuel?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And under FDOT policies in place at the time, motorists who paid with $50 bills and occasionally even $5 bills were not given permission to proceed under the toll collectors filled out a bill detection report. With data about the motor vehicles, and detain. Can you imagine that?
I'm beginning to not be shocked by anything anymore.
Yeah, I mean, they held them back even for $5. Right?
They probably don't have the change.
Yeah. Oh, maybe, but who cares? Have change.
They're trying to get us to go paperless.
Yeah. Billionaires are dumping stocks. Economists know why. It's despite the 6.5% market rally over the last 3 months, a handful of billionaires are quietly dumping their American stocks in fast. Warren Buffett, who has been a cheerleader for U.S. stocks for quite some time, is dumping shares at an alarming rate. He recently complained of disappointing performance in dyed-in-the-wool American companies like Johnson & Johnson, Porter & Gamble, and Kraft Foods. In the latest filing for Buffett holding the company, Berkshire Hathaway, Buffett has been drastically reducing his exposure to stocks that depend on consuming and purchasing patterns. Berkshire sold roughly 19 million shares of Johnson & Johnson and reduced his overall share in consumer product stocks by 21%. Berkshire Hathaway also sold its entire stake in California-based computer parts supplier Intel. Wow. With 70% of U.S. economy depending on consumer spending, Buffett's apparent lack of faith in these companies' future prospect is worrisome. Unfortunately, Buffett isn't alone. And fellow billionaire John Paulson, who made a fortune betting on the subprime mortgage meltdown, is clearing out of U.S. stocks too. And during the second quarter of the year, Paulson's hedge fund, Paulson & Company, dumped 14 million shares of J.P. Morgan Chase. The fund also dumped its entire position in discount retailer Family Dollar and consumer goods, making Sara Lee. And finally, billionaire George Soros recently told nearly all of his banks, sold all of his bank stocks, including shares of J.P. Morgan, Chase, Citigroup, and Goldman Sachs. Between the three banks, Soros sold more than a million shares. And so why are these billionaires dumping their shares of U.S. companies? Well, after all, the stock market is still in the midst of its historic rally. Real estate prices have finally leveled off. For the first time in 5 years, they are actually rising in many locations. The unemployment rate seems to have stabilized. Well, it's very likely that these professional investors are aware of specific research that goes toward a massive market correction as much as 90%.
Wow. And we have come right to the end of our show, Leo.
We still got enough. I want to read the rest of it. It's very likely that these professional investors are aware of specific research that points toward a massive market correction as much as 90%. And one such person published in this report is Robert Wiedemeyer, an esteemed economist, out of the New York Times bestseller book, Aftershock. Now, Wiedemeyer gives proof of his dire prediction in this shocking interview. I'm going to refer you to the article. It's rather long, and there is an interview here. And this is part of the that is part of Money News. You can go to moneynews.com and check this out. Check this article out. So quite frightening. I've seen that interview as well. It was more of a prepare for a market correction.
Goodbye music on, and good night, folks, and have a great evening.
Good night, everybody.
And talk to you tomorrow, I hope.